My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mark. We have had a good time this weekend. And I'm so glad that Linda came with me. We have fun, a lot of fun. We live in Los Angeles. We have a 13-year-old, Calico. And I like the cat. I like the cat. I just want to say this. I have not, in the years we've been together, seen anything as like a flicker of recognition in that cat's face. And I'm not even going to bring it up. I'm not even going to mention it. We have fun. And we work together. And boy, I remember not that long ago when I first started my law practice, the idea that my wife would be in there and know where all the bones are buried would have scared me to death. But we have a lot of fun there too. I had my last drink on the 14th of August, 1966. I was 29. I lived in Glendale, California. I'm 67 now. And so this 38 years with you has been remarkable. And the last dozen of those years have been the very sweetest of all. And I'm glad to be here today. I'm glad to be here at this important conference that you have every year. And I was glad to hear the other speakers. I was glad to hear Carl and a lady from New York who gave such a touching account of that 9/11 event. I was glad to hear Clancy last night. I rarely heard him in better form. And I've known him a long time. He's not here. I'm going to tell you. I've got a few things to say. Oh, and by the way, I wanted to say, apparently, Joe is 111 years old today. That's remarkable. Joe, are you here? Well, could you just kind of raise a hand, maybe? Oh, it says Joe is ill. Oh, hell, well, no wonder he's here now. Yeah, it says he's ill. Years ago. In Los Angeles, Clancy came up. He had been at the Midnight Mission for maybe a year. He said, you guys, to three or four of us, you guys want to come down to the mission next Sunday night, because there'll be a guy down there putting on an NFL film for the guys that are living in the mission. And so we thought that'd be a good idea. And the story developed that this guy that was going to be going down there had been ordered by the courts as part of a sentence to put on a film every month for a year at the Midnight Mission. He was a wide receiver for the Los Angeles Rams. He was a national figure and a very good football player, and he had gotten arrested for possession of marijuana in the Los Angeles airport and for some other stuff. And he was sentenced in part to come down to the mission. And we were excited. And we weren't sober very long, and it was a big deal to go down there and meet this guy and see the film and talk to him. And we went down there. And Clancy had, as I said, been at the mission for maybe a year by that time, and he was very good with those guys. And the guy came in, and we'd been sitting in Clancy's office, and he got all his, he came in a little bit late, but he got there and he put on that NFL film for about 60 guys that were sober and clean and asking good questions after the film was over. But this guy was apparently in a hurry because he wanted to get out of there. And he was a little short with him. We're all collected after this in Clancy's office, and this NFL wide receiver for the Rams was wrapping up his gear, and then he came, put it in his truck, and he came into Clancy's office with a sheet of paper and said, would you sign this, please? And he said, sure. And he signed it, and he said, okay, good, thanks, I'll see you next month. And Clancy said, don't come back. I don't want you back here. He said, I got to come back. The judge ordered me to come back here. He said, the judge didn't order me to have you back here. And I don't want you back here. And he said, why? And we're all sitting there watching like it's a tennis match. He said, well, you showed up late. There's 60 guys out here waiting for you. They're not really very important in your world, but there are 60 human beings that are sober and clean and waiting for you. And you didn't have the capacity to surrender to the clock and get here on time. And he said, after you put on that film, you almost answered their questions. They ask you good questions. And you just didn't seem to have the time to address them. As he said, I'll tell you something. These guys have given away their dignity, perhaps, but we're never going to take it from them. And I don't want you to come back. Well, that guy was having a fit. He said, please, you got to give me another. And we're just all like sitting there like flies on the wall. Finally, Clancy relented. He said, come back one more time. Well, you can be sure that we were all back there that we wouldn't know what was going to happen. That guy got there early. And he put on the film, and after the film, you would have thought that group of maybe 75 guys that time were members of the Rams board of directors. He's very courteous and very warm and outgoing and elicited more questions, and and he learned something about human dignity as out of that experience, and I did too, and Clancy can be kind of a figure that people like or dislike, and I understand that, and I've had my days when I liked him and days when I didn't like him, but he has made a difference in the lives of a lot of us. And those kind of events that just seem to come to him without any question, with great certainty, are important events. And so he's not here this morning, but I wanted to snitch. He'd hate to have you find out he's a nice man, but he is. And so I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous several years earlier. I was living over in Glendale at the time. I'd had a tour of duty as a Marine Corps officer. I'd mishandled it badly because of drinking. I had before that gotten deferments so I could stay in dental school, and I'd gotten thrown out of dental school because of drinking. And my life was a mess. I got out of the Marine Corps with an honorable discharge. I moved to Glendale and I lived in an apartment for a while, and then in the car, and then in a little shed. I called it a double garage. It was a shed. Linda and I were over there a few years ago, and she said, I want to see that shed you live, that garage you lived in. We drove down, and she said, is that it? And I said, yeah. She said, that's not a garage. That's a shed. And, I looked again, and by God, no car had ever gotten in that place. I lived in there. I later came to know a guy by the name of Earl Rogers. His mother was a notable writer. Adela Rogers St. John's had made some essays after her entry into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read those essays. They weren't published. She said, after this long, sterile diet of snake pits and manure piles, on which no roses ever grew, I longed for hope, and you gave me hope. And it touched me because there was that in the picture. I longed for hope. That terrible, smelly, empty little 8x10 room I lived in, with the steel cot and the wet mattress on it and the awful smell and the sticky linoleum floor, is something I don't have much trouble recalling. What I have trouble recalling is the terror of it, is the hopelessness of it, is the night that that rat was laying over there in the corner that turned in the first light of dawn. I looked again. I sneaked a look at that rat from under the bed, and it had turned into a pair of socks laying over there on the floor. And that's a singular event. If you've ever been held hostage by a pair of socks all night long, welcome home. I had a radio that would just play, a little clock radio. I never knew what time it was, but it would just play, and it wouldn't stop, and you have to pull a plug out of the wall. And it would still play. And you take it out and put it in the dirt outside the door, and it plays. I was sober some months before I got another angle on that clock, because I listened to a woman say in AA that she had been arrested for taking a hammer to a parking meter. And I asked her why, and she said, because it was, after the meeting, I said, why did you do? She said, it was broadcasting every rotten thing I ever did. That's alcoholism. The jails are part of it. The terror is part of it. I hadn't seen my kids in some time, and I did not want them to see me. I'd been married twice, and I have three sons, and I don't want them to see me like this. And I many times said, guilty, Your Honor, guilty with an explanation. Whatever Judge Ken White in the Glendale Municipal Court seemed to be going for. And I'm walking away one morning from that little shed, going nowhere. Couldn't stand to be there. It was going to be a hot day, and there's a honk from a passing car, and it pulled over and stopped. It was my bail bondsman, a guy that I had done some business with. And I walked over there, and he said, I'm going to take you someplace today. And he brought me to you. He brought me to you. And I was in that Glendale Alano Club, whatever that means, going to meetings every day for 3 weeks. And then I ran across a stash of amphetamines in cash, and that requires a drink, as you may know. And I was gone for 2 weeks and came back to Los Angeles on the 14th of August, 13th of August, and got back to that little nasty, smelly, terrible room. And I walked over to the club in Glendale that morning, the 14th. And I didn't have any hope. I just couldn't stand to be in the room. I didn't want to be on the streets. I had no job to go to. I was selling encyclopedias door to door, I told everybody, but I didn't have a job to go to. When you ask me what I did for a living, I always started that sentence with, well, right now, in the way alcoholics talk about their work when they don't have work. When they don't have the work they want and are trained for. And makes them feel productive. Well, right now. So I walked over to the club, and I walked up that long flight of stairs that day. And it was going to be a hot day. And there was somebody in the middle of the morning when I got there doing his job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the door was open and the lights were on and the coffee was made. And Bill Kennedy stood there. And I pushed that door open. He was there. He had the sweetest smile. He had the most wonderful, welcoming air about him. He had no judgment attached to him. I felt awful about myself that day, as I had so many times. And he's smiling. "How are you doing?" I said, "Not good." He said, "What happened?" I said, "Well, I got drunk again, let everybody down. Like AA and Glendale's going to collapse, I guess. I don't know what the hell I thought." He said, could have said a lot of things, you know. "Well, you didn't go to enough. Well, do you have a sponsor? Well, do you..." He didn't say that. He asked me a very simple question. He said, "Are you alcoholic?" It's a good question. It's a good question. And I don't know the answer. I mean, I know what he's looking for. And I've been drinking badly a long time. But I don't know. But I knew he wanted to know, and so I didn't want to annoy him, because whether I could stay in out of the sun that day and not get arrested that day seemed to me to be up to him. And I didn't want to offend him, and I finally said, "Yeah, you know what, I've been an alcoholic about a month now." He didn't even blink. He said, "So, you're an alcoholic and you got drunk?" I mean, he blew right past that "I'm a mild case" thing, you know. About a month, right? Just caught it. I don't know what happened. Some toilet seat deal. Who knows? Hey, not my fault. He said, "So, you're alcoholic and you got drunk?" He's smiling. I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, we do that. That's the deal. That's the deal." He said, "In fact," he said, "if you're an alcoholic of my type, you're going to do that." He said, "You will drink no matter what." Now, that's a pretty serious indictment, even though he's smiling. And it was true, and I knew it was true, and I couldn't have said that. And the cat's out of the bag, and he said, "You will drink no matter what, and I drink no matter what. I tell you, I'll be home right after work." I don't go home. I stop for one. I'll bring the check home. The check does not arrive, because I have to stop and cash it. And to be sure, I put the family money in one pocket and I put 20 in the other pocket in case I want to drink. But I'm not drinking, I'm just cashing a check in that bar. But you have to have a drink. The guy was nice enough to cash the check. But since I'm not drinking, I pay for it out of the family money. I don't get into my money. If you understand that logic, welcome home. We are. And after a while, the family money's gone, and then I have to get into my own money. And that's when it occurs to me that, God, I only got 20 bucks to drink on. That family, you know, you really get a sense that the family's a load at that moment. I drink no matter what. And this guy said it out loud. And I had been trying to quit. And there's no quitting. That's what it says. That's what it says. We're not going to quit. There are people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they get the heat off and they go on about their business. Those are hard drinkers. The ones that are described in the book, who, if a sufficiently strong reason arises, such as a marriage or an illness or a death or something, they can quit or moderate. I've had guys say, yeah, when I was in graduate school 4 years ago, I didn't drink for a year and a half. And I know I'm talking to somebody that is a hard drinker. If I were talking to an alcoholic, he'd say, yeah, and I got thrown out of graduate school because I had drunk all the time. There's kind of a divide. I'm just reflecting on that singleness of purpose. We have a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, of course, that did an awful lot of stuff besides booze. But if we're the kind of people that drink no matter what, doesn't matter much what else we've been doing, we belong here. And we're seeing more and more of that in AA, of course, and we've learned, I think, not to get judgmental of people just because they've had some drugs, if they're alcoholic. And we, you know, the set test is pretty simple. In any case, I'm alcoholic because I drink no matter what, and I cannot quit. I cannot quit. There is no sufficiently strong reason that comes up for me that makes a difference for me. I drink no matter what. And he threaded the needle that day and the cat's out of the bag, and I surrendered to that simple idea that I drink no matter what. I did not surrender to God or to AA, really, but I knew that morning something I had not really accepted. I drink no matter what. I cannot quit. And you know, the weird part about it is, although we sometimes talk as if we had quit drinking because we're no longer drinking, very few of us can lay claim to that. There comes a day. Remember when you first got into that book and started reading that awkward language in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you see things like, our troubles arise out of ourselves, we think. You go, wow, that's weird. I hated that sentence. And I realized as I went through that it really means, the subtext means, no one else has to change for me to get free. That's what that means. It's the biggest promise of hope in the book. No one else has to change. And I always wanted people to change. I wanted my mom to be, I wanted dead people to change. I wanted, if they're dead, they're not like in the basic security of your life and your sense of well-being on whether a dead person will change is not really going to spell out a happy life. We're fretful, we're almost irritable and discontent when sober. The other thing that was weird in that book when I first read it was that sentence that Bill uses. He says, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Oh, how nice for you, Bill. Oh, we're all so glad you had that white light thing going on. Because I got raised in the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, and I'll tell you, they spoke like that. They spoke of white lights. They spoke of miraculous conversions. They spoke of passing somebody in the airport, and lo, he was brought to the Lord on his knees in front of all the other passengers. I never believed a word of it. Where is that guy now? I ask all the rude questions. Because it didn't seem to me that God paid any attention to me. And because I was quite convinced that when I died it was going to be even worse. He had something very special in store for me. Burning forever, things like that. And because I knew I was a bad boy. I had thoughts that were just not very realistic, but they were always there. I got baptized in the Yellowstone River when I was 12 years old, early one March. Water about 28 degrees. I didn't find God, I'll tell you that. I didn't find anything for about 3 days, as I recall. That scares a little plenty, I'll tell you that. So Wilson comes into God, comes to most men gradually, but it's, I don't think so, Bill. And then one day, and I'd been here for a while, one day you reread that book, you read it with your heart and not your head, and it changes it. It changes it. Because on the 14th of August, I was a drunk, and on the 15th of August, I didn't drink. And I haven't had a drink since. And that's happened to every one of us, hasn't it? We call them birthdays. Birthday. Birthday. I go from drunk to sober. I don't know it's happened. But it happened. And it happened in a day. It happened in the blink of an eye. As it must happen. We are the people who cannot quit. And we're not drinking anymore. And if you're new here, as the days and the weeks go by, you'll be asked, when was your birthday and when was your last drink? And you'll count back and you'll, oh my God, it's been 5 weeks, it's been 8 months, it's been whatever. 9 months, I realized I hadn't been drinking. And I've been in your midst, and I've been in your meetings, and I've been setting up chairs, and I've been surrendering to the clock, and I have been here talking about maybe someday getting a sponsor. But I didn't drink. From that day 38 years ago when Bill Kennedy with a smile on his face said, you're going to drink no matter what. And he was right. In and of myself, I drink no matter what, and I didn't drink after that day. And that's a miracle, and I somehow have a tendency to take credit for the miracles in my life, and I miss the miracles in that way. And that was a flat miracle that occurred to me. And I'm very aware of it today. I'm very aware of it today. And it's not a... We celebrate that every year, and we have the problems of living as we go on. And it distills down in a spectacular way to three little prayers, doesn't it? It's not complex for us. Very important for us. There's one prayer, and if you're new, you might say it. Help me. Help me. He'll do that. There's another one. Give me. Serenity prayer is one of those. Grant me serenity. He'll grant you that. And when all of that is done, there's another one. Use me. Use me. What else are we going to do? He's given me everything I need. He's helped me in all areas of my life. He's done it for me, really, more than helped me. Use me. I'll show up for that. It's one of the reasons that Mark is such fun to be around. He's in the thick of it. You know, there's something about step 11 that says, what did I contribute to this stream of life today? In order to contribute anything, you have to be in the stream of life. Have to be in the stream. I can no longer stand at the edge of the stream and think about it. I have to get in the damn stream and make my little contribution, whatever it is. I have to surrender to this day, to this hour, to walk from my office 60 feet down the hall to Linda's office and say, you know, I used a tone with you this morning. I know it hurt your feelings. I'm sorry about that. And she smiles and forgives me. And it's a big deal in our home. Forgiveness has become a big deal. And over nothing, the biggest forgiveness is over. We were out with couples, another couple, and I told a story one night as we were standing around the parking lot after dinner. And it was about some excursion, and my version of the story put me right at the center of it in nice lights. Linda didn't interrupt me, but she just added in a few details after that that were part of the story, but ones that I wouldn't have put in there. And she didn't do it out of any rancor at all. She just thought they were interesting details. We got home. I didn't say anything. But I'm angry. It's a little deal. I'm going to rise above it. I'm too spiritual to get all angered in that sort of thing. We went to bed. Linda had the bad manners to go sound asleep. Nothing like, "Are you okay, honey?" She's gone. The 13-year-old is over there purring. And I'm staring at the ceiling. And I finally got it after an hour. I went into the study and I on that piece on forgiveness, and I let that go. I let it go. I mean, why am I going to hang on to that? Let it go. And with God's grace, I just let it go, went to sleep, and didn't say anything about it, never did say anything about it. Till about a year later, I was telling some other married guy that. And Linda overheard it, and she said, "I didn't know anything about that." I said, "Well, there wasn't any point in bringing it up because it was a non-event, except in my little gourd where all non-events claim rent." So the years have gone by in sweet, sweet ways. But I didn't take a drink after that. And Wilson is right. God comes to most men gradually. He doesn't come to me gradually or to you. He comes to us in the blink of an eye. Do we know it? No. But he comes when we need him. When we die the great death, everything but God, he is there. He honors the slightest turn in his direction when we stop trying to do it ourselves. That's amazing, and that takes a little bit of living here. I was talking to Don this morning about a day, and it wasn't that long ago when I couldn't have said that, couldn't have believed it. I was in AA a significant number of years, running my life, managing, running as hard as I could, being worried about my image in AA and elsewhere. God, it's so interesting to lug around an image. When I was in the Marine Corps, they had us put branches on the trucks so they looked like trees. My trucks always looked like trucks with branches on them. I got this image here. But God comes to most men gradually. His impact on me was sudden, and it was profound because he went right to that little piece of me that always needs a drink, and he removed that obsession. And without the obsession, the craving isn't triggered. And then I wasn't quick to leap to taking these steps, not because I'm lazy, not because I don't love AA, not because I'm not grateful to be sober, but because, I tell you, it just, and it's so subtle, but I know these steps work for you. But what if I take them and they don't work for me? What am I going to do? Where will I go? Better not to take them than to take them and find out they don't work. And I went for quite a while doing that. Got to 9 years sober, my world changed because the state of California gave me a license to practice law, which is amazing. Took me a long time just to fill out the application with all those rude questions on it, like, have you ever been arrested for anything other than a minor traffic violation? And they leave three little lines. You're right, see attached page. Bundle it up with twine and send it out. They let me take the test. I'd been 4 years at night law school. And I passed the test, and I've been doing that, and I have... I was looking for power, of course. I'm always looking for power. I'm addicted to power. I love power. Lack of power would not be a dilemma for me if I didn't dig power. That I'm alcoholic and I'm powerless. That's a difficult concept, isn't it? I don't have any power. He has all power, none left over for me. Hard to get. There is an analogy I like. I'm in the middle of the ocean. Land is not visible in any direction. I've got a raft. I'm alone. I've got a paddle. I'm furiously paddling. Gives me the illusion of power to make that little raft go around in circles. So I spend a long time circling the drain, as we say. But I'm not going anywhere. I don't have any power to make that raft move in any direction, much less the direction I may want. And one day, one remarkable day, from some place in my mind I never use, it occurs to me to take off my shirt and attach it to that oar and stick the oar up in the air and catch the power. I get moving. Get moving. Get moving. It's not my power. But if we lead a life that is consistent with that power, if I can line up my will in the morning with God's will, I'm going to spend the day being off target most of the day. And it's only if I get way out here in the far country that I've got a problem. And at the end of the day, I can look at all of that. So was I contributing anything to the stream of life today? Those questions don't really... Mostly, was I thinking always of other people or concentrating on myself? The answer to that is almost always, yeah, I was concentrating on myself. Rarely thought of anybody else. It's just a human life. I don't beat myself up about it, but it's just interesting. But at the end of the day, and I do it before I leave the office, when we retire at night, if I wait till I get in bed, fatigue takes over and I get done. So I do it before I leave, because I'm usually going to a meeting or to be with Linda. And I want that to be particularly sweet. And all of this started in earnest 14 years ago, because I lost everything I had. I worked so hard to get the right house and the right car and the right lady in my life. And because I was angry at my mother when I was a little boy, because I stood at her grave when they buried her when I was 14 and said, I don't love you. You never loved me. I don't love you. And because I was a long time getting back to that grave, I wandered in the far country without relationship. I had arrangements, and that's a big difference. An arrangement is just a contract. You do this, I'll do this. And always with its penalty clause. Aha, you didn't do this. Aha, you're changing. Yeah, I do that. Well, that's not acceptable to me. Of course, a relationship is about change. It's about growth. It's not about who do I go to the dance with. It's not that kind of shallow security that we're after in a relationship. And you can't have a an arrangement with God. And I'm a spiritual seeker. I want a relationship, and I didn't even know what it looked like until I went through these steps, until the time came when I had failed badly in sobriety and lost everything. I had to transfer my practice to some other place and build it up again, and I was frightened, and I moved out of a lovely home to a little apartment, and I was afraid that I would end up walking the streets, broke, failure. And out of all of that, somehow or other, my heart broke open. It had broken before, as our hearts do. My heart broke open. And I wound up finally getting to a point, and people took care of me. Guys took me through these steps. Guys that had been there themselves. It's an amazing, amazing transformative trip. And I got to step 9 because I had the power from 8, because I had done 7 and had that, and 6 had given me the power for 7. It's an important sequence. It works the same way our minds work. They said, yeah, you've got to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, because steps 4 through 9 are contrary to your will and against your life. And you won't do them unless you are tapped into real power. Hoisted the oar with a sail on it. That gives you a sense of direction. And I wanted a sense of direction. Power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction are promised us. And that happens. And then you begin to take other guys through the steps. And that's an amazing process. I knelt at the grave of where my mom and grandmother were, right in that cemetery in the low rent part of the Billings Cemetery, one weekend, and wept all my tears. Finally back there. Finally could see, because I had been changed by these steps, that they always loved me, that I could always trust them. We can't get how far off we are in our thinking, because I evaluate my thinking by using my brain, which is like having a hound dog's guard the stakes, you know. It's not really... I have a couple of friends that live in Norwalk. They're great guys, and they're both members of AA, and they have alcoholic minds like I do. One of them is looking out into his backyard one day, and he sees... that his dog has the neighbor's rabbit in its mouth. And he doesn't want any trouble over the rabbit. And so he runs out there and he grabs the rabbit. The rabbit's dead, but he brings it inside and he washes it off and he blow dries the rabbit. And he waits until dark and he sneaks it into that cage next door. And 3 weeks goes by and he sees his neighbor out in front, the other AA, and he says, "How are you doing?" The guy said, "I'm doing great." He said, couldn't leave it alone. He said, "How's your rabbit?" He says, "Funny thing, that rabbit died about 6 weeks ago and I buried it, but now I see it's back in that cage." Good thinking. Good thinking. So we need a new mind, you know. That's that psychic change, entire psychic change that Silk Worth talks about. It's really a new mind. And we get that going through the steps. And we get a relationship with God going through the steps. And we come out finally at step 9 to being at peace in the world around us and knowing that our mothers or our fathers or whoever it was loved us. Not some dismissal, "Well, they did the best they could." No. No. They love me. That's my mother. I am of her. Day never came she didn't love me. And in my childish anger, I extinguished that. And it changed forever the way I think about my mother. It changed forever the way I think about women. It changed forever and fundamentally whether I could have a relationship in my life. And it was only then that Linda came into my life. And we were friends. And the friendship caught fire. And we came back here to Kansas at my suggestion to talk to her dad, who was in a retirement home, had a little room about 100 miles south of here. And we're in that room. There's just a bed and a chair and some personal effects. And her dad is 93 years old. And he's a sweet man. He wasn't there moment by moment, but he was there. Linda was sitting on the bed with him. I'm in the chair. I said, "Mr. Staub, we flew in here from Los Angeles today. I've fallen in love with your daughter. I want to marry her. And I want your blessing." And he looked at me, Linda's sitting next to him. She's got a tear in her eye. He looked at me for a long minute and finally said, "How's the weather out there in Los Angeles?" I said, "Close enough." "Damn right, I'm going for it." And we lived the sweetest life I've ever known. I remember when I was a kid, 4 years old, my mom, before all the troubles seemed to start, would come and tuck me in, pray with me. We'd whisper our secrets. We'd tell our little stupid jokes. I'd try to get her to laugh. Sometimes I could. It was a sweet time, and then it was gone. And Linda and I wake up in the morning and we tell our secrets and say our prayers, set our purpose. And that sweet time is back. Even though we've had standard scuffles, I got a diagnosis earlier this year that I didn't want to get. Then I had the surgery. And we've all got a lot of people with diagnoses in this room, but it scares you a little bit. They removed my prostate 4 months ago, I guess. And you don't know quite what's going to happen. What's this relationship going to turn to? How much time do I have? What will I do? And it comes back, use me, use me, use me. My recovery really took a turn the day that some guy came over that I'm taking through the steps, and he and I kneeled down at our couch and said the third step prayer together. I had a friend, a good friend in Arizona. I've known him for all this time. And he called me and said, "I have a story for you." And I said, "Yeah." And I was in pain and I was afraid and I was taking medication and all of that. But I was glad to hear from Howard, and he said there's a guy that was a skydiver. He loved skydiving. He loved it. Loved it. He spent every nickel and every hour he could spare getting into an airplane and going up and popping out of there. Loved it. One day he's up in the airplane and he's getting his gear together. The door is open. He's about to put on his parachute. The plane lurches out of control in an updraft, and the pilot kind of overcorrected it. It tilted. This guy, without his parachute on, went out right out the door. And Howard said, "You know, he had that choice at that moment that all of us do." I said, "Yeah, what's that?" He said he had the rest of his life to really love doing what he was doing or live in abject fear. And I got it. I got it. Do what I love to do. And I love to be with you. I love to be with my wife. I love my work. I love God. And it's a sweet life. We've gone swimming a month ago now. I said, "Pull over to the side. Pull over and stop." We were on our way home from swimming. I need to say something to you. And I said, you know, I don't think that sex thing is coming back. And I want you to know that I'm okay with that. I'm at peace with that. And I want you to know that I've fallen in love with you all over again. And I want to know how you feel. And she said, I've fallen in love with you all over again. My wife told me that. And so, we just do this day, knowing that all our needs are going to be met. That the joy is always there. That we are so fortunate. That we know fundamentally, finally, and at long last that God loves us. And the proof is so easy, because if he didn't love us, could we have spent this weekend loving each other and laughing and crying and being together? No. We'd be alone and afraid and someplace else, but we're here. And his love is abundant. Thank you.